I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello and welcome to our live audience and to our podcast listeners. This is the Golster Magazine Show. I am Humphrey Hawksley, and today we are lucky to have one of Britain's leading philosophers, and we're going to talk about good and evil, love and hate, values and purpose. My guest is Emeritus Fellow in Philosophy at St. John's College, Oxford, and has a raft of connections to universities around the world. For the last 15 years or so, he has concentrated on examining human nature. The latest in his series of four books on this compelling issue is called simply The Moral Powers, A Study of Human Nature. And my guest has been described as the most subtle and penetrating philosopher of the age. But what exactly is a philosopher? Welcome, Peter Hacker, to the Golster Magazine Show.
Thank you.
It's very good to be with you. Now, I knew that I was going to ask you this question about what is philosophy, so I Googled it before we came onto the show, because we always have this assumed knowledge that we know things that we don't, and it came up with philosophy is a theory or attitude that acts as a guiding principle for behavior. Is that right?
Very misleading. The term philosophy has had many uses over many centuries. And one use is when we talk about a philosophy of life is roughly speaking the set of ethical beliefs that you have. That's not the sense in which professional philosophers at universities or writers about the subject of philosophy are philosophers.
So Google got it wrong.
Philosophy in general...
Sorry, go on. I just wanted to make the point that Google got that wrong.
Bear in mind that until relatively recently, science was empirical science, physics was referred to as natural philosophy, and there's still a chair in natural philosophy at the University of Oxford. So those are just different uses of the term. But philosophy, in the sense in which I do the subject, is an investigation into what does or doesn't make sense. Why is that important? Why is that interesting? Well, because not everybody, but many people have a craving for truth. But you can only say something true if what you say actually makes sense. And there are plenty of things that we say which appear to make sense but don't actually make sense, or they appear to make sense but they don't actually have the sense which they appear to have. They may have some sense. So the investigation into sense is a precondition for the possibility of achievement of truth, and that's why philosophy is very important.
Okay.
That's why, I was merely going to say that when faced with a question, don't rush to answer it. First of all, pause and think hard about whether the question makes sense and what sense it makes and what presuppositions it has.
Okay, because I was going to ask you, but I think you've noticed, what does philosophy try to achieve? And your answer to that is that we can make a better sense of the world around us?
Oh, well, we can make a better sense of what is told us about the world around us if we are clear about the concepts we're employing in thinking and saying what we think and say. Let me give you a few examples. We have a very wide range of concepts of emotions, ranging from the rather atypical emotion of love to a whole host of emotions such as anger and enjoyment, sorrow, grief, cheerfulness, which is a mood. We have a whole range of expressions. If we think hard about them, and if philosophy can shed light upon them, we are better able to reflect on our own lives and our own emotional lives and the role of the emotions in our own lives. In that sense, philosophy can be a substantial aid to self-reflection and self-understanding. And that is of very great importance in human life.
Indeed, it has. And I was, that is fascinating. But when you talk about does the question make sense or the statement make sense, we are in the middle of an election campaign at the moment where everybody is talking at us about all sorts of things. What role can philosophy play in that?
Well, primarily critical. So when one party or another makes a certain promise, first of all, what exactly do they mean by what they say? They're going to improve education. Well, we'd all love to improve education, but what counts in their eyes as an improvement of education? And similarly, it's examining what philosophical training facilitates is a clarification of statements made. And in elections, very often, the advantage to the politicians is to obfuscate as much as they possibly can. But what we need, above all, is clarity, not obfuscation. And that's what we should demand of our politicians. And any philosopher or any critical person looking at what politicians have to say will challenge them on the vague claims they make and the vague statements they advance. And the extremely unsystematic and unclear promises they deliver, they make. So
I just wanted to say, because I forgot to say this just now, is that for our podcast listeners and live audience, we record the show for about 40 minutes now, and then we have to say goodbye to our podcast listeners, and we open up the floor unrecorded to our live audience to talk directly to Peter Hacker. So whatever he's saying now, if you take umbrage with it or want clarification, you can ask him directly then. But until then, you can please send in your comments, criticisms, philosophical thoughts to the chat. And we will, if it takes us off on a tangent, we will go on that tangent. You were talking there, it begged a question, because you went to Oxford as an undergraduate in 1960, when Harold Macmillan was the Prime Minister, and the Beatles had not even hit the Hit Parade at the time. Now we have Taylor Swift causing earthquakes around the world with her concerts, and a carousel of prime ministers that we don't trust very much, do we? How would you sum up the difference between now and then? Because you are still at Oxford. I mean, you're still in the same place.
Well, Oxford has changed enormously, and Britain has changed enormously. I'm not sure which you want me to talk about. Oxford, I suppose.
Your view, Peter.
I want to talk about Oxford. Oxford has become far more centralised than it ever was when it had a far greater degree of autonomy in relationship to the university. And the college appointments for fellowships, the colleges had control, now the faculty has control. Above all, the university has become heavily bureaucratized. The huge bureaucracy dominates the university. And on the whole, I'm myself inclined to think that the bureaucratization of universities is inimical to the pursuit of truth. I think a powerful bureaucracy in a university actually stands in the way of serious research and commitment to truth.
And just that comparison again, because what you were saying before about having to sort of be hold to account, in the election, trust is another emotion or another factor. Has that diminished in the, since 1960? Is that a changing element in our lives?
In general, yes. I think one of the consequences of politics over the last 20 years or so, perhaps longer, but certainly the last 20 years, is that we've shifted in politics gradually from a position in which the norm is trust, and you take it for granted that somebody who is talking to you is reasonably honest in what he's saying. We're shifting towards where the norm is distrust. And when somebody says something to you, the first question is, can this possibly be true? And that's supported, of course, by the development of mass media and the iPhones and everything that goes on, particularly among young people, with the use of iPhones. And that facilitates extremism and diminishes the possibility of serious debate. Because as soon as you can press a button and call up another 10 or 20 or 100,000 people who agree with you, then all the others are the baddies and you don't have to agree with them. You agree with them. All you have to do is shout and scream at them. The centre tends to be squeezed out.
Yes, and how does so that because you are still lecturing, teaching students, how has their attitude changed?
I'm not quite sure. I give lectures voluntarily, and they're open to any student who wishes to come, as far as I'm concerned. And the ones who come to listen to me are obviously self-selected. I don't know that they're representative. They seem to be very eager to hear the kinds of things that I have to say, because the kind of philosophy I do is out of step with what is done in philosophy at the moment, both in Oxford and to some extent elsewhere in other universities in this country. So I'm not quite sure. There's still obviously very good students come here, and I certainly get very good students in my seminars here in Oxford at the moment. But how representative they are, I've no idea.
You mentioned out of step. I was going to get onto it anyway, because you have a reputation of sort of slaying the establishment. Tell me, why are you out of step?
The methods that I employ in trying to solve or dissolve or resolve philosophical questions, conceptual questions, are logico-linguistic. That is, I look very carefully at the way in which we use the key notions involved. If there are worries about the nature of the mind, I will start out by looking at how the word mind is used, perhaps looking at its etymology and how it developed over the centuries, perhaps looking at other languages where they may or may not have a term that is exactly equivalent to the term mind. And these are logico-linguistic methods of what I called a connective, contrastive, and contextual analysis. Now, that's very, very much out of fashion. Today, philosophers tend to opt for one theory or another and to do philosophy by confronting one theory with another. In the sense in which there are theories in science, there are no theories in philosophy. The sense in which there are theories in philosophy is that they're doctrines. But I don't myself believe that the way to do philosophy is to pursue one doctrine or another, or to contrast one doctrine to another. I think you should go to the fundamental data of examining the forms in which we think, the ways in which we think, the reasons we have for thinking as we do, and to be highly critical. So right. Criticism is perhaps a key notion here.
So I want to follow your out of step way of doing things, because we have you with us. We've talked about what is philosophy a little bit, and you've given us a wonderful answer there. But before you did your four books on human nature, you studied and wrote about cognitive neuroscience. Now, neuroscience is neuroscience, but you are not a neuroscientist, are you? So tell us a little bit how that comes together.
I worked together with one of the greatest neuroscientists of the last 50 years, Professor Max Bennett, who was at Sydney University, who approached me in the year 2000. And we started talking together at great length, wrote a few papers together, and ended up writing a 600-page book together. And we've written four books since then. So we've written three books since then, so four books altogether. My knowledge of neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience, largely comes from reading what Max Bennett told me to read and a lot of other books that I stumbled across. Cognitive neuroscience is, roughly speaking, that branch of the study of the brain which investigates the neural preconditions, concomitances, and correlates of our exercise of our capacities for thinking, reasoning, feeling, perceiving, and so forth. It's a widely spread sphere of investigation for very, very many contemporary neuroscientists. And in both my view and Max Bennett's, a great deal of current research is flawed by ascribing to the brain certain kinds of attributes, which it doesn't make sense to ascribe to the brain at all, because they're attributes of human beings, not of brains, in the following sense. It's human beings who think, the brain doesn't think. There's no such thing as a thinking brain any more than there's a thoughtless brain or a mindless brain. It's human beings who are thoughtless and mindless. So it's a fundamental error to ascribe attributes of human beings to brains. Let me clarify that just a little bit more.
Yes, please.
Take a machine. Aeroplanes fly. They can't fly without their engines, but their engines don't fly. I have a long case clock here in the room. My clock keeps time. It wouldn't keep time if it didn't have a great wheel, but the great wheel doesn't keep time. So the fact that a complete being as a whole, a human being as a whole, can do various things, and it's a human being's capacity to do what it does, including thinking, depends upon its having a brain, does not mean that the brain is doing those things any more than the aeroplane engines fly.
The brain is just part of many things, so that I'm talking to you and my brain is telling me to talk to you.
No, it's not.
It's not. What is telling me to talk to you?
Well, nothing's telling you to talk to you, but you're fulfilling a certain social role which you've adopted, and part of that social role is to do certain things, and you know that perfectly well, so you're doing exactly what that social role requires you to do.
You mean it's a mesh between whatever's happening up here, and I want you to explain that a little bit more, to my hand picking up my coffee cup, to my tongue moving around my mouth.
Let me put it this way. Without what's going up here, you couldn't walk, but you walk with your legs, not with your brain.
Yes, I see. But then the element of the brain, I mean, we have the body, we have the brain, and with all that, we have our sense of self, our sense of ego, and we have this thing called the soul, which does or does not exist. And we have a word called the mind, which is not the brain. Can you bring all those thoughts together for us?
I can try. Again, you need to look rather carefully at all those different expressions. We talk extensively about the mind, about a thought crossing our mind, a thought at the back of our mind. We talk about making up our mind. We talk less about losing our mind or being out of our mind. Endless English idioms. If you look carefully at all those idioms, each one of those idioms is translatable without loss of meaning into a form of words in which the word mind doesn't occur. So, for example, I can't make up my mind means I can't decide. He's out of his mind. Well, he's lost his rational faculties. He's in two minds whether to do something. He's undecided. What else? His mind is in a turmoil. He's confused.
You revise
a decision you made previously. So all those idioms, and there are dozens and dozens. English is particularly rich here. There are dozens of idioms like that. What's most interesting about it is all of them are translatable into the ascription of certain kinds of activities or properties to human beings in their lives. What that implies is that all our talk about the mind is not talk about an entity of any kind. The mind isn't a something. It's not a nothing either, but it's not a something. So you can't, the question, is the mind the same as the brain? It's a silly question, because the mind isn't a kind of thing at all. All our talk about the mind is a rather complicated way of talking about human capacities, in particular intellectual capacities, capacities of thought and decision and reasoning. Right? So, as it were, once you take that on board, once you understand that, then you will realize that the question whether the mind is identical with the brain is a foolish question, because it's not the kind of thing that could be identical with anything. It's a way of speech. The question, what is the mind, is a bad question. The good question is, what has to be true of a creature for us to say of it that it has a mind? And the answer is, it has to be able to do all manner of things, like decide, reflect, reason, contemplate, think through, and so on and so forth. So shifting the question from what is the mind to what has to be said, has to be true of a creature that has a mind, is a crucial move of huge importance.
Would it be fair to say, and I know that I'm wrong on this, but I'm going to try to adjust it so that I can, is that the mind is a bridging concept between the brain and the rest of the body, or is something that makes us human?
No, that's quite wrong. All our talk of the mind is simply a form of presentation. It's a form of talk. It's a way of presenting human intellectual and volitional capacities. And capacities aren't identical with the brain. Human beings have capacities, right? The only capacities the brain has is to oxygenate, metabolize, pass minute electric currents across appropriate synapses, and so on and so forth. The brain is not anything that doesn't... The brain doesn't do anything terribly interesting in human terms. So it's not the brain that falls in love. It's you who fall in love. It's a human being who falls. It's not the brain that is afraid of something. You're afraid of something. Of course you wouldn't be in love, fall in love, hate, admire, all the things that you without a brain. But as I said, you wouldn't walk without a brain either, but you don't walk with your brain, you walk with your legs. The brain is a precondition for everything we do. Without a brain, we're dead.
Right.
It doesn't mean that the brain does all the things we do.
So that brings me to, because we're going to get onto human nature in a minute, but the human being, does the dog, the antelope, an animal have all those attributes that you're talking about, or is it just a human thing?
Well, we are animals of a certain kind, so-called Homo sapiens. It's a misnomer because wisdom is a pretty rare commodity. Homo loquens would be a rather better Latin phrase, namely talking man. We are language users, and we're the only creatures on Earth that are language users. Because we're language users, everything that makes us the kinds of beings we are is the fact that we're language-using animals. So, for example, animal thought is almost non-existent for the simple reason that animals can have no awareness of anything that happened in the past, and they can have no long-term thoughts about the future. They can't reflect on themselves. They can't reflect on what's happening to them, because they don't have a language. So let me give you a vivid example. A lion takes down a zebra. Mm. The herd is in terror and it runs away. Lion takes down the zebra, is sitting there eating it. The herd is 300 yards away. Within 10 minutes, they're champing away eating grass again. Perfect calm and quiet. Well, if they were language users, they could have the thought, my God, 10 minutes ago, the lion took one of our brethren.
Yes.
But if you don't have a language in which you can refer to the past, you can't think about the past. Nor can you think, well, in the future, we'd better be jolly careful. And you can't think about the future because you don't have any means of referring to the future. You need a tense language or time-referring expressions in a language. Animals, as it were, live in a perpetual presence. Animals don't live in time, in a sense, in a metaphorical sense, or quasi-metaphoric. Animals don't live in time.
So when you have a dog welcoming you back home, for example, and you've been away for 6 months, that is not memory or the past, it's something else.
It's recognition. The dog that hears your footsteps on the path, having not heard you for a long time, will recognize your footsteps. Can it expect you to come home tomorrow? Can the dog expect you to come home next Wednesday? The dog will be delighted if you give it a bone, but can it be excited at the idea it will give you a specially large bone on Christmas Day? No, because it has no means of referring to the future or to Christmas Day. That's a prerogative of language users.
Okay.
So animals can have rudimentary emotions, rage, anger, lust, if that's an emotion, questionable.
Is it an emotion? No, it's not.
Lust is...
Hunger, is it?
Lust, yes, hunger. It's an, yes. Appetite, an appetite.
Yes.
So animals can certainly have appetites, hunger, thirst, lust, can certainly have sensations such as pain, perceives things, perceives the world around it. What it can't do is think in articulate manner, because for that you need a language. Everything that's distinctive of humanity is because we are language users. Many of the emotions like remorse and regret, shame and guilt, indeed emotions such as love, are not available to animals, strictly speaking.
Right.
They don't have the conceptual apparatus which is presupposed for those emotions.
Right. And we've got some prompts coming in from our audience here. So let me run them by you. Rebecca said, Rebecca's loving this and she loves philosophy. And I think she came up with them Suri came up with a different mind over matter, which I thought was good. And then Ben, who's running the show, said mind the gap, which is the one that we hear on the tube station all the time. But Rebecca says each creature makes decisions and takes actions, though, doesn't it?
Yes. As long as what is required for the decision instating the decision and action, you don't presuppose mastery of a language.
Right. And Rebecca also says, do the birds not use a language, only we as humans can't understand their language? The tweeting of the birds? No.
No. Bird song, which of course isn't song. We call it bird song because it's attractive to us. Birds tweeting as a set of signals, but they're not symbols. Many animals have more or less elaborate, some very elaborate signaling systems, but they don't have a language. A language involves the mastery of symbols in which the use of symbols is rule governed and can be correct or incorrect, and incorrectness is normally corrected by the parents or by the other members of the community. Yeah. If you misuse a term, somebody tells you, what do you mean? Or you've misused this word. You don't have any of that in language among animals. And as bird song, with some birds, evolves in the course of the summer, no other bird comes and tells it, no, that's the wrong song.
I'm with you. Yes, okay.
It doesn't tell you, that particular twitter, you didn't get the right note.
Yes, okay.
It's not part of the song. It's the signaling systems, sometimes very evolved signaling systems. Yeah. Usually of mating calls, territorial claims, territorial announcements.
Yeah.
But they're not the use. It doesn't involve the use of meaningful symbols for communication.
We have another goal's remembered, taking you to task. Suri says elephants have good memory and relationships as well as strong emotions.
Oh, they have really. Elephants have fantastic memories. But the memory can't be articulated in linguistic form. That is, what you get is an elephant having gone through a waterhole 40 years ago, perhaps in time of great drought. If a drought recurs, that elephant may lead the herd to the waterhole where it was previously. That's an associative capacity, and they have very, very long-term associative capacities. That doesn't mean that they have articulate memories in the sense that they can say to themselves, I was there 40 years ago, wouldn't it be a good idea to go there again? For that, you need a language. So what you get is very powerful associative behavior, very powerful associative memories. So if you maltreat an elephant and disappear for 10 years, come back in 10 years, it will recognize you as an enemy, as something harmful to it, and may attack you.
So through this back and forth, which has been fascinating, thank you, everybody, have we sort of concluded what is distinctive about human beings in the world in which we live? What sets us apart? Or is there anything you'd like to add to that?
We have knowledge of good and evil. No other animal has that.
Yes, I want to talk about that. But firstly, I want to talk about getting to good and evil. We hear in our political system as well about values, the value connected to life, the good of man, that sort of thing. Tell us about that, Peter.
Well, I suppose the first question is to look at the source of value. I mean, how is it that there is value in the world at all? How is it that there are values? Things are of value to some beings. And the answer is, well, as soon as there are living creatures in a world, then there is value in that world. That is, even if you have a world where there are only plants, there is already value because some things will be good for a plant and some things will be bad for a plant. Because wherever you have life, you have a life cycle. You have, as it were, the seed, you have growth, you have production of further seed, you have metabolism, you have decay, decline, and death. So you have things that are good for the organism. When you get beyond plants to more developed organisms, then you get more involved forms of value. But value is a feature of life. A lifeless universe is a valueless universe. Any world, or any planet, whatever, any world in which there are living things of reasonable degree of development, then there are forms of value in that world. What you need, and of course, there are a multitude of values because you want to distinguish between what is good for the creature, and that, as it were, contributes to its health and well-being, satisfies its needs. But then when you have more evolved creatures, then you have a differentiation of capacities. So the adult female elephant is far more skillful than the elephant young or by and large than the males. Because it's a matriarchal. So once you have skills, you have differentiation of labor. Some members of a group will be more skillful than the others and will therefore start occupying a more prominent position. And that's perfectly natural because they can contribute more to the group than the less skillful ones.
So and this is across the board. This is animals and humans that we're talking about.
We are animals of certain kinds. What differentiates us is that we're language users. That opens up horizons which are far, far greater. In fact, the horizon of human experience and human thought is limited only by the limitations of language.
We are language users, but do we have a conscience? We talk about morality. We have a conscience. But does a dog or an elephant also have a conscience of what is cruelty, what is good, what is bad? Or is it just us?
I think not. The pet can cringe because it knows that if it's made a mess on the carpet, it's likely to get slapped or it will be punished in some way. So it will associate what it's done with punishment. The idea, the thought, I ought not to be doing this, that's only possible for a language-using creature. Animals can't have anything remotely like a morality. What they can have is a complex set of patterns of behavior and associative behavior, which you get especially with developed predators that hunt in packs, such as wolves or hunting dogs. Right. There you get very, very complex patterns of behavior, which have evolutionarily developed so as to minimize conflict. Right. So, for example, the fact that a wolf faced with a wolf that is stronger will roll over on its back and expose its belly, and that triggers an aggression reduction trigger because it won't be attacked. It will have signaled that it's subordinate to the alpha male or the alpha female, whichever it may be. So you get complex behavior patterns, but you don't get anything like a knowledge of good and evil, because for a knowledge of good and evil, you have to have articulate notions of what is of supreme value and what is of supreme significance. And that's something available only to us. If you like, we are the only creatures that ate of the tree of good and evil.
Right. But we had your predecessor on the show, we had a week ago, Rebecca Tinsley, told us, because she does a lot of work on genocide and human rights abuses, and told us that when there's a group of people with peer groups saying, yes, it is okay to go and kill these people, that will supersede any morality or good and right that they might have been taught at school. Does that ring with you? And could you expand on that a little bit?
Oh, yes. Well, we have a capacity for good and a capacity for evil. You might ask, what are the roots of human morality? And my own view is that the roots of morality lie in our natural capacity for caring, particularly caring for others. One prototype, exemplifying morality would be the maternal relationship to the child, right? And the mother's caring for the child, and hence also the mother loving the child, which is the norm. So caring is a capacity most of us have, to caring for others, I mean, is a capacity most of us have. And it's sociopaths who lack that capacity. There are some people, right, unfortunately, born without the capacity to care for others and for the welfare and the good of others, and they're sociopaths. Now, the capacity for caring can be cultivated in the family, in the society, in the social group, at school, or it may be crushed either by the exigencies of life, the awful, appalling conditions, or by the family, or by suffering. On the one hand. On the other hand, it can be cultivated and developed. Unfortunately, we have a strong tendency to succumb to our most wicked inclinations and bury our consciences and our moral sensibility in the behavior of the mob or the mass, a large group. It's an unfortunate feature of the kind of animal we are. We actually enjoy destroying things given the opportunity, many, many of us. We also enjoy losing our identity in a mass. So you just have to look at large crowds shouting and screaming together. What goes on there is a temporary loss of identity and the burying of your own identity and your sense of responsibility in the emotion of the masses. You just have to look at really rowdy demonstrations, or look at photographs of the Nazi party and the great gatherings before Hitler. The Nuremberg rallies and so on and so forth. There's a loss of sense of where you bury your identity in the emotion of the mass at the time. And that also, of course, involves running riot, slaughtering some minority. The pogroms were notoriously the case of all restrictions being lifted. You identify with the leader, you do whatever the leader tells you to do, you bear no responsibility at all. Right. And in certain circumstances, certain kinds of people find that deeply fulfilling.
So
and that's a terrible, terrible thing, isn't it?
And as Suri actually asked about spirituality as a moral compass, but let me expand that onto the religion, which I presume animals don't have, but we do have. What is that in the, I don't know what to call it now, Peter, the human mind, the human brain, the human nature, that we sort of follow this thing? And you've been talking about it a bit with this, you know, losing our identity in something else. Christianity, Islam, spirituality, one political party or the other. Is it all the same process?
No, it's certainly not the same process. They're very different processes and very different systems of belief and systems of commitment. Here I have to be personal. I think that on the whole, religion has done infinitely more harm than good. We'd be better off without particularly monotheistic religions. I think that monotheistic religions tend to be far more intolerant than polytheistic religions, and certainly far more tolerant than what I would call, roughly speaking, humanism. So intolerance is a corollary of most forms of monotheism, particularly Christianity and Islam, extremely intolerant religions. And if they've been burning people at the stake or torturing them in most hideous ways for, in one case, 14 centuries, in the other case, for the best part of 17 or 18 centuries. I think that monotheistic religions are by nature intolerant, polytheistic religions much less so, and humanism, in principle, is very much more tolerant.
And so when you say humanism is more tolerant, is that because naturally we are pragmatic or kind as a sort of animal, but it's these groups that make us commit acts of cruelty?
Well, I don't think, I mean, the group doesn't make us do it. We allow ourselves to get swept away. Whereas, as it were, the fact that you got swept off your feet by the passion of the mob doesn't relieve you of responsibility, anything but you are responsible for that. Just as if you get blind drunk and smash up the pub, the fact that you're blind drunk doesn't relieve you of responsibility. You shouldn't have got blind drunk. So too, if you allow yourself to be swept away by the irrational passions of a mob bent on destruction and murder and slaughter, doesn't relieve you of responsibility. You should not have allowed yourself to get swept away.
Yes. Just categorize for me, I mean, we talked about good and evil, but what is evil? How do you actually identify it? I mean, the person that gets swept away, they might not be that intelligent. They might just be sort of following something they think is good, ends up doing dreadful evil. What is evil exactly?
The unwarranted infliction of cruelty and death upon innocent human beings.
And if an animal does that, it's not evil because they don't know?
Animal will kill for food. Some animals on some occasions will go and get into a frenzy of killing, like a fox in a chicken pen.
Leading there.
But by and large, no, the animals can't be morally good or evil. They can be aggressive or less aggressive. That depends upon the type of animal and the occasion. But animals can't be good or evil. They don't know the difference between good and evil, or right and wrong.
Yes, we are running out of time for our podcast listeners, so I'd just like you to sum up. You've done four books, the categorical framework, intellectual powers, the passions, and the moral powers that you've done now. Just encapsulate for us. This has been 15 years plus a whole life of work. Encapsulate for us in a minute or two what you've concluded from it.
Well, I suppose the most... Well, there's a lot of methodology there, which I won't talk about again. I suppose the main thing is the exploration of the extent to which everything... We are animals, but everything that makes us distinctive animals in the world we know, in the world on Earth, is the fact that we're language users, and the explanation of how that impacts on every sphere of our lives and our capacities and our relationships. It's our capacity to think, our capacity to reason, our capacity to look for justifications where justifications are required, and our capacity to realize there are certain things which are right without being justified, for which no justification can be given. They're just fundamentally right things to do. The most blindingly obvious form of evil will be the slaughter of an innocent child. The most terrible thing to do. Right? That's an absolute pure evil as such. And if you ask me, well, why is that evil? I don't have an answer to that.
It's
so fundamental that if that's not obvious to you, I haven't even common ground to talk.
We should all follow we should all look more deeply into philosophy, and then we would understand ourselves and the world better, wouldn't we?
I think if you find philosophers who are able to argue clearly and perspicuously, and I think that's something all philosophers ought to be able to do and ought to do, then yes, one can learn a great deal. And there are some people who write very lucidly for an educated audience. Philosophy is difficult. You can't make it easy. It's a difficult subject. But yes, it's well worth scrutinizing lucid writers who have contributed to the subject and who write clearly and will help you understand both yourself and the world you live in and your relationships to other people.
That's it. Times Wing Charity Tax for our podcast audience, alas. Find out more of our podcast by Googling simply Goldster Podcast. You can hear Lord Nigel Crisp, who used to run the National Health Service, Lord Richard Dannett, who used to run the Army, the tireless Bonnie Greer, whose philosophy in her 70s is to take up boxing. Tell your friends to find Goldster's favourite philosopher there shortly. And thank you, Peter Hacker, for giving us such a brilliant Goldster conversation. Really, really good for me. I've got a million questions for you. But do we all understand a bit better about human nature? I think we do. Thanks, Peter. And for our podcasters, goodbye.
You've been listening to a Goldster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Goldster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.